This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am Jen Crichton in for Helen Farmer this week. And today we were talking divorce do-overs. Rory McIlroy's done it, but what happens if you start on a split and then change your mind? We got into that with lawyer Byron James. We were also talking about nut allergies and how to make sure you stay safe flying if you suffer from one. As a leading US health official calls on social media companies to put smoking-style warning labels on their platforms, we asked two experts, how dangerous are the sites really? And how can we protect our kids? And we found out more about the GCC's first ever menopause summit and what it means for women in the workplace. If you enjoyed this podcast or the show, please do share and tag us on social media. We are Dubai Eye 103.8. Right. We're talking divorce now, or more specifically, what happens if you file for divorce and then change your mind? That's what's happened with golfer Rory McIlroy. He made quite a lot of headlines, actually, when he filed for divorce in May. I think it came as a surprise to a lot of people. It created a huge amount of coverage. And then last week, he voluntarily dissolved the petition. He said he and his wife, Erica Stahl, had reunited and they were pictured out together with their daughter. And they said, you know, let's respect our privacy. We're trying to get our family back on track, which obviously very happy thing if that's what they want. But it does beg the question how common this is and also what sort of issues it raises if one spouse has raised a petition like that. I'm not sure I could come back from that. I like to think I'm a fairly forgiving person, but I think if my husband asked for a divorce and then kind of said, oh no, it's okay, I've changed my mind, that I might have reservations about the future of our relationship. I'd love to hear from you on this. Let me know what you think. 4001, could you forgive someone if they filed for divorce and then changed their minds? Have you done it? I would love to hear from you if you've done it. We're going to be getting into certain nuts and bolts of it now, though, because I'm joined in studio by Byron James. He is partner at Expatriate Law here in the UAE. Byron, hello. Thank you for coming in.
Hello. Good afternoon.
How unusual is this? I can't imagine it happens a lot, does it?
It doesn't happen a lot. I mean, I will say that we get inquiries to our firm for people who want to know more information about divorce and then they don't follow up. Or they might send an email and they'll say, hello, I'd like to discuss a divorce, and then you never hear from them after that. And I think that's normal because people are just looking to assess their options. But I wouldn't say it's particularly common for somebody to go to the length of filing a petition, serving that petition, and then saying, actually, I've changed my mind.
And especially someone as high profile as Rory McIlroy, it seems really a very strange measure to do it and to have all of those headlines and it be so public, which of course most of us wouldn't experience. Is it something you've experienced here where people have actually gone to the extent of filing and then said, actually, I've had a change of heart?
Yes, I have had it. And I think it's all in context. When people feel that a relationship has come to the point where it's irretrievably broken down, which is the test for a divorce, then that could be contextual. It might be that something's happening in their life, which is very stressful. So when you're talking about Mr. McIlroy, he obviously lives a very stressful life of being a high-profile sports star, but also his family being in the public eye, and that has extreme stress. And so the context is very important when we're thinking about these things. And when somebody makes a decision to issue a petition, so mechanically that would be for Mr. McIlroy telling his lawyers to issue it, I don't think he personally did it. You know, maybe it's in a moment of a low moment or an emotional moment or in the heat of an argument that a snap decision is made. I will say that the decision to withdraw it was pretty quickly after it was issued. Yeah. So I assume that it was just a moment of regret that he quickly, within a matter of a week or so, realised that it wasn't the right thing to do.
What's the legal position on this? I mean, where would you stand if you were to do this here? And then decide, actually, you had been too rash, you didn't want to push ahead right now.
So up until the moment that a court orders you divorced, you can always withdraw the proceedings by the consent of both parties. So here in the UAE, we have a no-fault divorce system for non-Muslims, both through the non-Muslim federal law, but also through the Abu Dhabi Civil Family Court. So you don't need to prove a reason why you want to get divorced. Whereas in the Muslim personal status court, you do need a reason. You need to place fault as to why the relationship and the marriage is broken down and cannot be retrieved. So it's a different system depending on who is applying. But in a no-fault divorce system, if one person wants to get divorced and the court has jurisdiction to deal with that case, then the court will order them divorced. And it's only if they withdraw their case, then the court won't order them divorced.
And is that sort of different in different emirates here? Because I know the laws in some areas of divorce are different in, say, Abu Dhabi from Sharjah or Dubai.
Yes. So we have the federal non-Muslim law that applies across the country.
Okay.
So that's in every personal status court. We also have the personal status law for Muslims, which applies across the country. And then the only emirate that has its own particular jurisdiction is Abu Dhabi, with the Abu Dhabi Civil Family Court. And that's available to Muslims and non-Muslims, just for who are foreigners from non-Muslim countries. So Article 5 of Regulation 8 says persons covered by the law are foreigners who come from non-Muslim countries.
Now, where you have seen cases like this, where someone has maybe gone to the point of considering divorce or filing for it and then changing their mind, do those relationships recover? Do you tend to find that those people end up back in front of you a short time later?
I think there's no general rule. The thing about my job is that there's so much, there are so many different variables when it comes to relationships. There's no such thing as normal, and everyone has their own thing. I think it really just depends on the reason why they thought divorce was their only option at the time. And it's why, by the way, that when people are thinking about divorce or going through troubles in their relationship, it's always a good idea to consider couples therapy or counselling to really see if you can work through those issues before you proceed with legal options like a divorce. Because ultimately, particularly if there are children involved, there might be really good reasons to try and save a relationship. Although I will say on the flip side that if you're sure that a relationship's over, or if there are, should we say, toxic or abusive aspects to a relationship, then you certainly shouldn't stay in a relationship that isn't making you happy or providing you with a safe place to be.
We've had a message on the note of counselling, actually, from Kim. She says she's a divorce coach. And she says, I've had clients who have separated and started the divorce journey only to then reconcile. And I've had clients who think about separating and have then decided to stay with their partner. Some are still together, a handful are not. I would say the majority have done a lot of work on themselves with a coach or a therapist. And as a couple, they need to get to the point of living fulfilled and happy lives together. I mean, that's kind of in line with what you're saying. Do you find that a lot of couples have gone down that route before they get to the point of divorce? Or is it quite often that they sort of come to you and then think, oh, well, maybe we could still get some help here and bring things back on track?
I think that's a really interesting question, because quite often why relationships break down are communication issues. People aren't able to communicate their own needs or unable to respond to their partner's needs. And so those communication issues can then find themselves manifesting in the way in which they separate. And that's why relationship counsellors perform an important role, because they can try and provide a way for those people to communicate and try and find a way to solve their problems. And so if people aren't able to communicate and they just reach an impasse, then sometimes divorce can seem like the only option.
Are there particular reasons that you see as being the most common when it comes to divorcing, and particularly here in the UAE with families, expat families, I guess?
I think there are lots of different reasons why people divorce. Particular to expats, you'll have people move out here maybe for work, and maybe one person doesn't enjoy it, and then that can put strain on a relationship. You can have people being separated from their families back home and feeling quite isolated. Those are common things that people say. I will say that the most common period times in a year when people get divorced are usually around the holidays. Unfortunately, during summer holidays, we see a lot of child abduction, where people go home for the summer and then just not come back. That is often a precursor to a divorce for expatriate families. And also the Christmas holidays as well, where people are off work, at home for extended periods of time, and then all being together in one place can really put a strain on people's relationships. The other thing to remember is that in terms of the time for people to get divorced in their lives, the two most common times for people to get divorced, the most common is when the youngest child reaches the age of 18. And I think that's a lot about people, you know, they've grown apart, their child's off to university, and they're suddenly left alone with each other, and they look at each other and say, oh, it's you. You know, I didn't realize it was you. I'd forgotten about you all along. And then they decide to go on a different path. The other, and this is very sad, is within within the first year of a child being born. And I think that's a combination of financial pressure, maybe tiredness, and the strain of being a new parent. Some people don't take to being a parent very naturally or very well. There's also lots of stuff that can go on when a baby is born, health problems. And so that's a really sad common reason. And so that's obviously not to do with being an expat, but that's just generally.
It's an incredibly stressful time, isn't it, having little kids. And my son was actually, he was very, very ill when he was born, and his dad and I separated and ultimately divorced when he was still quite young. And I think, yeah, absolutely, it was a combination of all of those things you mentioned, you know, having a sick child, the pressure that that puts on your marriage, on jobs, on your time, on all sorts of things. I mean, it's an incredibly uprooting kind of insecure time for a lot of people, isn't it?
I will say, though, it's not just external factors. And one thing that I think is very modern is people making a decision and saying, I want to choose myself.
Yeah.
And people saying, this relationship isn't working for me. Either it's too controlling or I'm not able to thrive. And I want to choose myself and put myself first. And I think that's an increasingly common thing, particularly for women who I think are empowered by the world that we live in now. There's a lot more research available to people. There's a lot more they can do by way of podcasts or the radio or social media, where there are relationship counselors online giving people, you know, advice about how to live their best life. And I think actually it is those external pressures, but that internal decision to say, do you know what? I have the insight to say that this isn't right for me. I should be doing better. It's a sad decision. And if you have children, it has to be not just a selfish decision, it has to be a holistic one that takes into account everybody's needs. But you know what? Sometimes the best thing for everyone is for a relationship to end. And there are lots of studies done about the fallacy of staying together for the kids. That really is not a correct analysis. Staying together for the kids just means that you are putting your children in a toxic environment, quite often an unhappy environment, and you're teaching them that you shouldn't choose yourself, and you're teaching them not to put your needs first. And I don't think that's a good message for children.
That's such an interesting point. And I guess it is, like, kids, they say they're watching more than they're listening, aren't they, when they're little? And you're setting that example that is going to follow them through life, I guess, of what a healthy or an unhealthy relationship looks like, aren't you?
Well, one of the great differences I feel generationally from us to our parents is that we have so much more information available to us as parents than our parents did. And so for us, we have a huge obligation to our children. They look to us and they see from us behavior which affects their own self-esteem. It creates pathways for the relationships that they will think as normal in the future. So if you're a child and you grow up in an environment where relationships are between the adults are hostile, conflict isn't resolved in a healthy way, maybe it's not resolved at all because maybe there's an avoidance going on, what you're teaching your children is that's normal.
Yeah.
And then the sad thing is that when those children are adults and they're looking for what's normal and what they feel safe in, quite often they can then look for unhealthy, toxic things that feel safe because that's what they had when they were children. And so that's why making a conscious choice to say, this isn't working, this isn't right for me or my children, can actually be a positive thing.
What a note to end on. I could talk about this all day, but we are out of time. If people want to get in touch with you or reach you or want more information, where can they find you, Byron?
Luckily, I have an unusual name. Google Byron James and you'll find me.
Fantastic stuff.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jen Crichton, holding the fort for Helen here today. And we're talking next about nut allergies specifically, because UK Love Island star Jack Fowler's gone viral on social media after he shared a video which showed him suffering a severe allergic reaction, essentially, on board a flight from London to Dubai. Now, he says he was served a chicken curry that contained cashew nuts on board that flight, and he's been calling for greater awareness of the dangers of allergies. Now, for their part, Emirates has issued a statement. They've apologised for the incident. A spokesperson said the airline takes the health of customers extremely seriously and does its best to meet the specific needs of allergy sufferers by offering special menus that can be booked in advance. However, the airline stressed it cannot guarantee a nut-free environment and has urged travellers with medical requirements to consult the airline's website and their own doctors for advice. So it kind of got me wondering how unusual this case is, because I know that all of the big airlines now offer these special menus. My husband has a severe allergy. He's celiac. He's allergic to gluten. And we find that he always books a meal in advance. It always comes on a separate trolley. They're always very much aware of his allergies when they come round to serve snacks and drinks. It strikes me that allergies are fairly well controlled on board flights these days. So I was quite surprised by this. I'm joined in studio now by Bhavika Khatri. She's a former senior cabin crew member who spent a decade working with airlines, including Emirates and Qatar. Bhavika, how common are incidents like these days? Are they quite rare?
Yes, they have become pretty rare now because we've learned to contain them or help or assist in these kind of situations much better than we used to earlier on. So they are quite rare, and people are also very, very aware of how they can deal with their own allergies with the assistance, of course, of the airline. So very rare if you speak of it now. You know, airlines definitely offer so many meals which are, dietary specific, medical specific, even religion specific, you know, if you need them. So it's just that I feel nut allergies are very, very specific, and it's a very special issue. Gluten, lactose, these are all meals that you can easily order before you fly.
When a person gets on board a plane and they have an allergy and they've reported it in advance, they've requested the special menu like my husband does, are you made aware of it as cabin crew at the start of the flight? How is that communicated to the staff so that they're aware of what they're dealing with?
You know, mild allergic issues or allergic reactions, if you convey to the cabin crew, they would try to assist you. But life-threatening reactions that you might have, as in this case, I know on the Emirates website, you've got a medical information form. If it was my life that, you know, is in question, be it a nut allergy or any allergy of the sort, I would make sure I fill in that medical information form, because then it becomes very, very official. This will be discussed in the pre-flight briefing with all of the crew, and everyone is aware. So you're not relying on one single cabin crew member who's, you know, dealing with at least a minimum of 100 passengers or say 50 passengers by themselves. I would not risk my life in the hands of one person. Everyone would be aware. Everyone would be checking on each other. The purser would be checking on the crew if this passenger has been, notified, spoken to, made comfortable, etc. If the medical information form is in hand, then it becomes very official and everyone's aware.
Gosh, that's really interesting. So that's a form that people can just download on their chosen airline's websites?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If it's a life-threatening situation, you'll go on the website. There's so much information about nut allergies as well and flying with an allergy. So if I had a life-threatening condition, I would make sure that I have done my due diligence. You know what I mean? Instead of putting my life in the hands of someone who's extremely busy, extremely pressured, you know, it's my life at the end of the day.
We've actually got a nut allergy sufferer joining us from the Philippines on Teams. Apple Enriquez is with us. Apple, is that something you were aware of? Have you been made aware of these sort of medical forms that you can fill out to make the cabin crew aware of the fact that you have a severe allergy?
Hi, when I book any flight, local or international, I would always read the airline's policies regarding allergies, because mine is a very severe one as well. So I have to make sure that the airline is informed of my allergy. So yeah, I'm aware.
Have you ever encountered nuts on board a flight? Have you ever had an incident where your allergy was perhaps missed?
Yes, actually, I had an experience from my last travel. My Manila to Sydney flight. So I informed the airline about the allergy like 3 weeks before the flight. And then I called them, I sent them, I reached out to them through WhatsApp. But when I informed the ground staff about the allergy, and I want, because this particular airline has a policy that you can actually board ahead of the others, so you can like clean your area to make sure that your seat is free of debris. When I informed the ground staff, they weren't aware, so I was very surprised. And then when during the service, when they served the meals, it was my husband who spotted the salad that it has like crushed peanuts. So thankfully, I didn't ingest, I didn't eat the salad, and I already informed the crew, and I was very surprised because I already told them before I boarded the plane that I have the allergy.
What would have happened to you if you had eaten that? Do you have epinephrine? Do you have treatments that you carry with you? What's the procedure for you if you were to ingest nuts?
Yeah, for me, because in the Philippines, EpiPen is not very common. So I would always have like an over-the-counter antihistamine with me all the time. So, but my usual practice is when I'm eating something that I haven't eaten before, I would always smell it to make sure that it doesn't have peanuts. So I rarely like have an incident wherein I ingest a food with peanut, because I'm very I have a specific peanut allergy. Other nuts are fine, but peanuts only peanuts that would cause an allergic reaction for me. So anyway, if I ingested that salad, if I ate that salad, the first thing that would happen to me is that my throat and my ears would get itchy, because my allergy isn't manifested on the skin. It's actually in the inside. So like my air passage would get constricted and I would have a difficulty in breathing.
Goodness. Now, Bhavika, what is the procedure for cabin crew in that instance? What sort of training are you given to make sure that on those odd occasions where someone might suffer from an allergic reaction, what do the crew do? Do they have protocols in place for this? I assume they do.
Absolutely, we do. We've been trained in first aid across the medical spectrum, but we're also trained specifically for anaphylactic reactions. We're trained to use the EpiPen, administer the EpiPen on a casualty. Although casualties with a history of allergy, they're used to using the EpiPen. So we're supposed to check with them beforehand if they're used to doing it or if they're comfortable using the EpiPen. We provide the EpiPen. If not, we're trained to administer it the way proper first aiders are trained to administer, the EpiPen. Also, we're trained for the follow-up first aid, where we'll give them oxygen, we'll ensure their comfort, we keep monitoring till we land. And of course, the captain is kept informed so that, if we need to make an emergency landing or we can have a normal landing, all of these protocols have been, drilled in us. So we're very aware of how to deal with these situations if they occur. And, as I was saying earlier about the medical information form or any kind of information before, the airline also ensures that they uplift additional, medical supplies like additional EpiPens, oxygen bottles, etc., if we do have the information beforehand.
Haya's been in touch. She says her daughter has a walnut allergy. Haya, is that a difficult one to deal with on board? I don't know how the specific nut allergies work, but I hope that she finds it okay to fly. I've also heard from Lucy Freeman. She's the co-founder of Sticky Ginger, a company here in Dubai. So she flies a lot and she has a severe nut allergy. She sent me this voice note.
When it comes to travel, that can be a little bit difficult. I think the bigger airlines, when you actually book your ticket now with big airlines, you can actually request a meal on the flight with special dietary requirements. And that does include nut allergies, obviously. Personally, so I can do that. I know it's an option, especially on the big airlines. But because I do have a severe allergy, I actually have always traveled with my own food on flight. So, you might look a bit strange pulling out your own food. But it's for me, that just gives me that level of safety when I'm traveling. But I would say I haven't had any problems when I'm flying. I've always kind of felt that when you mention nut allergies on flights, you're always asked about the severity of it. And typically they are checking things. But personally, for me, when I travel, I just find it a lot easier, a lot more confidence by preparing my own food and taking that on board. And that really comes down to the fact that I know that I'm traveling. I know that I'm in the air on an aircraft. So if anything did go wrong, I know that it wouldn't be easy for me to solve that. But I personally, for me, I put a lot of it on myself to manage that. And confident traveling, confident eating out. And where I think maybe there could be a red flag I choose just to take my own food on that flight.
Bhavika Khatri is still with me. She's former senior cabin crew with Emirates and Qatar. Bhavika, interesting stuff there from Lucy, saying that she kind of takes it very much on herself to keep herself safe on board a flight. Do you see a lot of people who choose to carry their own food on board? And is that kind of widely accepted by crew, by airlines?
Absolutely, it is. If we're informed, primarily when people with nut allergies travel, I have seen it so many times. They have their own meals. I have flown with cabin crew who suffer nut allergies, who carry their own EpiPen and their food. And passengers travel on flights not every day. Cabin crew do every single day, and they choose to carry their own meals because, like I said earlier on, I would not, put my life in the hands of someone else when I know I'm fully responsible for it. I know there's cabin crew who are trained to assist you, make you comfortable and all of that. But if it's a life-threatening condition, I would carry my own meal. I would make sure that I'm reading the menu, also. If you were not given the menu, but you have a life-threatening condition, I would insist on having that menu. When you get on board, there's a QR code that you can scan also to check what's in the menu, if there's nuts, no nuts, etc. So I love that, she chooses to carry her own meals and take that little bit of, it's a huge responsibility. I wouldn't even say a little bit. It's hard. I can completely understand. But she's taken the responsibility of taking care of the allergy on her own instead of, telling a cabin crew twice and sitting back and enjoying chicken and cashew nut gravy. I would not personally do that. So I love it where people take responsibility for their own condition. But if they rely on the cabin crew for comfort, reassurance, that is completely reasonable.
And I mean, you mentioned earlier that cabin crew will do their utmost to help, but they are under a lot of pressure. I think maybe sometimes those of us who've never worked on board a flight perhaps forget how pressured an environment it is for you guys. I mean, how many people are you looking after on some of these big international flights? I mean, we're talking about big planes between London and Dubai, right?
Absolutely. A minimum of 350 passengers on board. If you're traveling economy, it could be a ratio of one cabin crew to, say, 50, 70 passengers. If it's a longer flight, then we work in shifts. So the ratio is, pretty disproportionate. If you see longer flights, you've got one cabin crew to 100 passengers sometimes. So it is a high pressure environment. It's a time sensitive environment. We're also looking out for a lot of other things on flights, say safety, security on board. Service is absolutely essential. That's what big airlines like Emirates, Qatar Airways, they pride themselves on. But our primary objective to be on board is to ensure security and safety of the aircraft, passengers, etc. Individual medical requirements are an added, kind of a service that you would want to provide, which is a courtesy kind of situation, because we're not trained medical professionals, we are first aiders.
So if you can, if you have a severe allergy, bring everything that you would need for the flight and make sure you fill out that medical form before you board would be
Absolutely.
Your key advice.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining me. That's all we've got time for, but amazing advice there. That is Bhavika Khatri. She's a former senior cabin crew member who spent a decade working with airlines, including Emirates and Qatar. And we were also joined on Teams by Apple and Enriquez from the Philippines. Thank you so much to both of you.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Bringing us into what is potentially, I think, a bit of a thorny subject. Certainly in my house at the moment, it is a topic of much debate. We're talking about social media. Now, I don't think I'm in any way alone in saying that I worry about its impact on my son. He's 10 going on 11. And he told me the other day that he reckons he's one of the very few kids in his class who doesn't have a smartphone. And recently we got a warning home from school saying that a number of kids in his year group, we're talking about kids who are 10, had been added to a very concerning WhatsApp group, that a number of them are now on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and Snapchat. And a number of the parents in the discussions around this were saying that they were equally as worried about the impact on their kids as they are worried about the impact of trying to keep them off social media altogether. and what that could do for them. I'd love to hear from you on this. Do your kids have social media? And if they do, what age were they? And how do you feel about them being there on the internet? It's a topic that obviously runs and runs a lot. But now one of America's most senior health officials has gotten involved in the debate. He's called for smoking style warning labels to be introduced on social media platforms. Now, this is Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. He said, and I quote, that the platforms pose a significant risk to kids and teens, and that they should specify as much on their homepages to remind parents and teens that social media has, quotes, not been proved safe. I am joined right now in the studio by Dr. Alison Burrows. She's a senior lecturer in education at Middlesex University, Dubai. Alison, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I wonder, first up, I mean, how are we currently educating families about the risks of social media? Do you feel that there is sort of adequate education out there at the moment for people on the risks of this?
No, I don't believe there's adequate education or easily accessible education out there. Some schools in Dubai send home a weekly newsletter that includes some kind of a cyber safety page or tip in it. I'm not sure that every school does this. I also know that technology companies make it really, really hard for parents to find out the truth about how different applications, different social media sites, and maybe even different games can have negative effects on the user.
And I mean, in reality, these platforms all have sort of age limits on them, don't they? I mean, most of them say they shouldn't be for under 16s. But in practice, are there actually any safeguards to stop a kid of 10, 11, 12, 13 signing up to these?
No, there is no accountability. And actually, you said 16. In the US, the age limit is 13. Ooh. So even a child who's younger than 13 can put in a fake birth date, push a button, and then there's no way to check if that child is actually 13 or older. So one of the first issues I see is that the age needs to be raised to at least 16. Some researchers are saying 18. And the next thing is there has to be accountability. The technology company needs a way to verify the child's age.
Now, from what you're saying, you are obviously a supporter of more safeguards in this space. But what do you think about this idea of kind of labeling? Is that something that you could see in action? Would you support that?
I would support it because this is the first step in increasing awareness. Over the last year, the research, the longitudinal research, meaning 10 years, has come out and it consistently shows a very, very strong correlation. So excessive screen time, excessive social media use typically leads to higher levels of internalizing disorders in teenagers. That's depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicidality. So yes, I'd be very much in support of warning labels as a first step. So parents can start getting the information. And so kids can even start saying to myself, oh, wait a minute, maybe I have been online too long.
What do you think that those warning labels could look like? Like, what sort of phrasing would hit home on that? Because I'm struggling to think what this, I mean, the thing with smoking is it's very visual, isn't it? We get those kind of health pictures, which are really quite horrific. But I'm not sure what the equivalent would be for social media.
Yeah, well, the last time I checked in the US, and it's been a long time, is the warning labels on the cigarette boxes don't have the photos. It's just
really?
The words. Yeah, so it's not as explicit. America is very interested in free speech. So showing something that explicit would go against what some people believe. It's a big mess over there. So I think one of the biggest things we're going to find is if this label is even allowed, which can be impinging on a person's right to look at social media consistently, what will this label say? I think this label would most likely say, warning, excessive social media use can affect your mental health. It would probably just be very plain and simple.
Do you think that's scary enough?
I think it's a start. It's very hard for me, even as a researcher, to predict how people will respond to this. I think the people and teenagers who are already addicted, I don't think it's going to make a difference to them. However, we know that labeling the cigarette box reduced smoking dramatically. 47% of Americans were smokers after they put the warning label on cigarettes. And to this day, it's down to about 11%.
I noticed you used the word addicted there.
Yes.
Do Do you feel that a lot of teens are addicted?
Oh, absolutely. So the recent research shows teens typically spend 4.8 hours a day on social media. So let's say they're spending 5 hours a day on social media times 7 days a week. That's 35 hours a week. That's almost a full-time job.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
And that's around school. That suggests that it's within school. I mean, that's or late at night when they're supposed to be asleep. I mean, that it's hard to see how you would fit that in without it being damaging.
Yes, exactly. And the research also very strongly suggests that, you know, with a device that can fit in your pocket, a lot of kids are putting the covers over their heads and they are interrupting their sleep time with social media browsing. So they are losing sleep.
And I mean, that's all very scary as a parent. And it's easy to say, well, in that case, I just won't let my kids on it. But in reality, that's a very difficult thing to do, isn't it?
It's incredibly difficult. Absolutely. And that's why we need collective action. We need groups of parents to come together and say, you know what, my child is not going to be the only one who's not on social media. I have this pact of other parents, and we're all not allowing our kids on social media until they're 16 or whatever age they think their child is mature enough to be able to handle it. Then your child isn't the only one.
And that's it, isn't it? That's the key, making sure that they're not...
Well, it could be damaging to socially isolate the child by that child not being the only one on social media as well. It's really a double-edged sword.
Isn't it, Alison? The fact that these platforms are profit-making platforms, and essentially as a user, you are the product, right?
Yes, yes. Your attention. It's the attention economy. So however long you spend scrolling makes the company more money.
And you were saying before that kids are spending... I mean, close to 5 hours a day on social media, according to research. What are the key kind of risks of that that educators particularly are worried about?
Well, there are several things. There are several things that are happening in classrooms and outside of classrooms. In classrooms, students are dealing with something called digital distraction, and so are teachers. So while they are supposed to be on a certain educational application, typically they're digital multitasking. So rather than using all of their cognitive and thinking energy to perform an academic task, they're in chat rooms, they're looking at social media, they're very good at getting around the firewalls in schools. Very, very good. And another thing that happens if the school has a very strict no smartphone policy or is very good at keeping kids off of apps they shouldn't be on, the child is thinking about maybe something they saw during recess on their social media account, or the child is thinking about how they need to answer a text message or answer something in a WhatsApp chat. So they're very distracted whether the device is in front of them or not.
I think it's the distraction thing is, I see it in my son. I mean, he doesn't have social media, but I see it just with even the games that he plays for school. You know, the sort of educational games that they get their homework set in. Sometimes I find like it's almost like he goes into a zone with the iPad already at the age of 10, where even though he's doing homework, it's quite hard to bring him off the screen. And that's before we get into the fact that the social media platforms are, as you say, they're built to keep your attention there. As a grown-up, I struggle with it sometimes. So, I mean, it must be incredibly difficult for those kind of developing brains to think, I've had enough, I need to step back from this device now.
Well, it's almost impossible because the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that controls impulses, that only starts to develop when a child is 7. It is complete in its development when an adult is typically between 25 and 30. So when we do put a device in front of a child and they're looking at a highly addictive application, a game, they don't yet have the brain capacity to stop playing and turn it off. Yeah.
Now, see, I hate saying this because I feel like I lose really big feminist points by saying this, but my husband is good at tech. I am not good at tech. And I was really impressed recently that when there was a bit of an issue with kids using a platform that they shouldn't have been at my son's school, that we got an email home that said not only that this was happening and this was what the risks were, but that any parent who wanted to could take their child's device into the school and sit with their cybersecurity expert while they looked at the settings to make sure that it was as safe as possible. And I thought that's actually brilliant because I wouldn't know
where to start.
Right.
But if I don't know where to start, I wonder how many parents are in that position and what they can do about it if they feel like, I know I'm not comfortable, but I don't feel like I have the expertise to intervene here.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a huge problem. A lot of parents don't feel like they know how to use the safety control settings appropriately. A lot of kids are really, really, really smarter than their parents with technology because they're digital natives. So even if the parents put on the most spectacular parent controls, the kids can get around it. So the parents also need to change their behavior, meaning not allowing the child to be on social media or on a device alone in their room with the door closed. Parents need to check their credit card bills. There have been cases of kids getting around firewalls and buying things online or buying access to control certain servers on certain games like Minecraft or Fortnite, for example. So it's more than just technical skills. It's really the behavior of the parent, how the parent is setting boundaries based on their own values about how much and what kind of screen time their child should be getting.
It's such a minefield. That's all we've got time for with Dr. Alison Burrows there. She's a senior lecturer in education at Middlesex University.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The UAE's number one talk radio station.
Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm Jen Crichton, standing in for Helen Farmer this week. And we're talking about social media right now. Now, we kind of came to this subject because the UN Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, said that social media platforms pose a significant risk to kids and teens that he thinks could be tackled by the use of essentially the same sort of labelling as we put on cigarette packets on the homepages of social media sites. He's saying that they would remind both parents and teens that social media has not been proved safe. Now, this comes just a couple of weeks after new research here in the UAE that found 85% of university students were spending 7 hours a day or more on social media. Now, clearly, that's a huge amount. And I can't help but feel that maybe that would not be reversed by a warning on the homepage, especially when you get to the sort of age of university students. Are they unaware? I am joined now on Teams from Australia by Susan McLean. She's a former police officer who was dubbed Australia's first cyber cop, and she's now the founder of Cyber Safety Solutions, which works to help kids and adults alike navigate the online world, essentially. Get your questions for Susan in on 4001. Susan, hello, how are you? Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure, and it's evening time in Perth, Western Australia, but middle of the afternoon in Dubai.
Indeed. It's a bit of a big question, I guess, first of all, but how dangerous do you think social media is from the work that you do?
So social media can be extremely dangerous. It can be extremely positive. It is a reflection of in real life. So there is good, bad, and in between. What we have to understand is that, in my opinion, in my extensive experience, a warning is really not going to fix much at all.
And why is that? I mean, I kind of feel the same way, but I'm not quite sure I could put my finger on why I feel it would be ineffective. I just can't really imagine it being effective.
So if you look at how young people use social media, and if you take TikTok, for example, if there is offensive content likely to be shown on TikTok, TikTok already puts a little bit of a warning up to go, well, if you really want to press ahead and watch this, it's not going to be really nice. Do you want to see it? Well, we know that probably over 90% of young people will go, sure, I'll take my chances. I'll have a look at this. It might not be pleasant, but I'm prepared to take that risk. So I don't think these prompts are going to do very much at all in stopping young people accessing content that is clearly not suitable for them. My main issue when it comes to online harms is the large proportion of adults that are putting their children under the age of 13 years on these platforms. So helping them to lie about their age, to sign up, to go somewhere they shouldn't be. If you want to reduce the harm for children, you have to A, make the platform safer in the first place, so they need to be fit for purpose. We need to educate parents about the reality, because that for me is how we're going to change the narrative here. If parents are aware and can actually open their eyes to the reality, perhaps they may not be so willing to sign up their children for these platforms against the terms and conditions of use.
Now, I think, you know, there's, as a parent, I find it a very difficult one because my sort of knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, my son just will not go on social media. It's too dangerous. Until I understand fully how to protect him, I'll just keep him off it. But the reality is that it's a huge part of a lot of people's lives nowadays. And there's only so much that you can kind of protect your kids from the wider online world. I mean, you said at the beginning this can be risky, it can be positive. What are the sort of different risks and rewards for different age groups, would you say? At what point does it become appropriate to start navigating this with your kids?
Well, I think that the conversation should not start about whether you should be there or should not be there until you have met the minimum age requirements, and that is 13 years of age. So under 13, you know, the conversation is around the fact that, you know, mum and dad are not going to help you lie to go somewhere you shouldn't be. You know, we're a family that follows the rules. Once you have a child that's 13, then you have to have these conversations with them. But it is about educating them to understand the reality. And the other thing that I get to see a lot is when parents base these choices on their own experiences of social media. And of course, that is very different because the way the algorithms work is vastly different. I had a conversation with a group of high school students recently, and they were complaining about the fact that they routinely got ads for vape on their social media account. I've never seen an ad for a vape on any of my social media accounts. So we need to educate. And I think once we can get to that point of really good knowledge, because for parents, if you don't know what you're protecting your children from, you are never going to be able to protect them.
It's such a fair point. And of course, none of us were ever really on social media, were we, as teens? I mean, it didn't exist when I was a teenager. And I was saying earlier in the office when we were talking about this that, I mean, to be perfectly frank, I was an idiot when I was a teenager. You got the freedom.
There's probably no record of you being an idiot.
Because exactly.
There wasn't the filming of you being stupid, which of course there is now. And that's the other competing issue. It's that digital reputation where what you do online, what is recorded, what is uploaded, what you're tagged in, what you're mentioned in, can actually have a significant impact on your future opportunities.
That's it. I mean, there are things that I did as a kid that I'm sort of like, oh, you know, we got away with it because we had that freedom. And the idea that now kids are living their lives aware of the fact that one mistake could follow them for a long time, I think is something that perhaps a lot of us underestimate, and especially young people underestimate, because once it's online, it doesn't go away, does it?
No, and this is what young people will say to me, oh, well, you know, I wouldn't be judged when I'm an adult on a mistake I made when I was a kid. And, you know, in a perfect world, no, you wouldn't, because people would understand that young people make mistakes. If you haven't repeated them, they're gone and away we go. A perfect example of this was an English test cricketer. So his name is Ollie Robinson. So he only in the last few years became a test cricketer. The day he made his test cricket debut for England, the proudest day of his life, the only media coverage was about some offensive posts he had put online 8 years earlier when he was in high school. You know, that's not fair, but that's reality.
That's such an interesting point. I've got a couple of messages have come in. The first says, the story of Amanda Todd is a tragic story of a teen that took her life because of online bullying because of some pics she shared. There is a real risk to kids online that we need to be aware of. And Brian has messaged saying, could there not be some sort of biometrics, a retina or fingerprint scan that's used by apps to determine a user's age that would therefore admit or reject entry to certain videos? An interesting idea, Brian. I'd be really curious to find out if that's the sort of thing that we have technology for yet. Susan, are we looking at kind of methods to keep kids off of these sites? Or is the brutal reality that there isn't much interest for the companies to do so?
Well, I mean, the companies will talk the talk and they will say that they are very, very passionate about keeping young users safe. In Australia currently, as in several other parts of the world, the governments now are looking at forcing social media platforms to do better when it comes to age verification. So currently you basically submit a date of birth, and as long as it's the right date of birth and you've done your maths, you're going to get access to that platform. The Australian government have now allocated a large amount of money to make it mandatory for age verification for pornography platforms. So one of the issues we are seeing, like in many parts of the world, is the effects of pornography on young people and their behaviours towards each other, particularly violence against women. So we are looking at products that will actually identify, is this person under the age of 18 years or over the age of 18 years? And those sort of products are, as your caller mentioned, biometric. So they are looking at products which would actually view the face of someone, not gather personal data. They don't know it's you. They don't know who you are. But by using that facial recognition and biometric technology, they will make an assumption of your age. And in my understanding, that many of these products are in the high 90% for accuracy. So it is possible.
Goodness. So hopefully there's that sort of thing coming down the track. And it sounds as though that potentially would be more effective than a sort of warning label like we're discussing today. But I mean, in the meantime, I guess you're helping parents with this stuff every day. What are the most common fears that parents come to you with? And what do you kind of advise them when they come and they say that they're struggling over whether to allow their kids access to these spaces or not?
Many parents really don't want to say no to their children. So for me, it's about empowering parents to support each other to say no, if that is the correct word to say. The very worst reason you can use to give your child access to technology is the fact that someone else has said yes first. Because yes, you might be depriving them of access, but you are keeping them safe from harm. And in the work I do with schools right around the world, it is about empowering adults to support each other to keep children safe, because in reality, not only do you have a responsibility to keep your own child safe, but you need to make sure that the choices you make with your children are not putting other children at risk. So the more, like, a group is only as strong as its weakest link. So if we can get school communities on board, if we can get them educated and empowered, we can do better. But we also need to hold the platforms to account. And this is where I think this warning basically abrogates the responsibility back to the user rather than the platform to ensure it is safe and fit for purpose.
That's a really interesting point. And I guess that is essentially what it's doing, isn't it? If we're saying, here's a warning, it's up to you if you choose to heed it or not. A very interesting point. Thank you so much for joining me. That is Susan McLean there. She is a former police officer and the founder of Cyber Safety Solutions. Susan, if anyone wants to find out more about the work that you're doing or to seek advice on what to do with their own kids, where can they find you?
So they can find me on Facebook as Susan McLean, Cyber Safety Expert. I post stuff all the time about current things, things of warning, what to be aware of. I have a website, www.cybersafetysolutions.com.au, and people can message me through all of my social media platforms. I'm on LinkedIn as well, or email me through my website. Now, I must say, I'm not a crisis line. You know, at 2 a.m, if there's a catastrophe, the local emergency number is going to be your friend, not me. But if there is a question that is not time critical, where a child is not in immediate danger of harm, more than happy to help out. And if there's any, you know, parents of schools in Dubai listening, you know, I travel right around the world delivering education sessions. So always up for a visit to a warmer part of the world.
I can imagine that that would go down very well here.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I have a question for you now. I want to know if you would feel comfortable taking menopause leave. Would you ask your company for it? And I wonder whether your answer would change if it was mandated in law. Because that's what Australia is planning to do. But now one senator there, Holly Hughes, has warned that the practice could actually have the reverse effect of what it's intended. She's saying it could discourage the hiring and promotion of women. She said, and I quote, "People won't employ women if all the mandated stuff that's going to come in comes in." That's the reality for those of us that live in the real world. Now, I'm going to declare an interest here.
I disagree entirely. I went into menopause at the age of 38 because I had surgery. So I effectively went overnight into surgical menopause. And what was interesting is that when I did that, when I had my surgery, I was in the UK. And at the time, it was a huge topic of conversation in the UK. It felt a bit like everyone was talking about menopause right then. I did not feel like I had any shortage of support around me. It was a time when women were all discussing it. There was endless podcast books. One of my best friends wrote a book on the topic, so I couldn't have had more support in the community. Where I did struggle was accessing the medical care that I needed. Here, having moved back, I think that conversation has perhaps not been as loud here. Perhaps until now, because I'm joined now in the studio by two women who are absolutely at the forefront of this discussion here. Polly Williams is managing partner at Tish Tash Communications, and Sophie Smith is the founder of digital women's health platform Nabta Health. And both of them have menopause and menstrual leave on offer for all of their employees. So I guess, Polly, first of all, the first question to ask you is, does Senator Holly Hughes have a point? Would women be disadvantaged by this in terms of how it's viewed in the workplace?
I think, yes, she may have a point in that. I think culturally, historically, there may be people at the senior levels in organisations that aren't prepared for this and don't necessarily know how to handle it. And that may result in some negativity. I think there is some validity in that. But the reality is, if we don't put things like this in place, how will those people at the top that are currently not educated, don't understand why it would be an issue for women, how will any of that ever change if we don't put these policies in place?
What's your view on that, Sophie? Do you agree that this is kind of potentially a double-edged sword, but one that we need to push on with anyway?
So I think in the short term, having menstrual leave, menopause leave, and more leave in general to support women with health concerns and goals in the workplace is essential. But it does broker a bigger question, which is, what is it about the workspaces that we have that make it difficult for women to exist in them at particular ages and stages? Do we need to be thinking about how we make workplaces more women-friendly, how we centre care more around women wherever they are, whether they're at work, at home, or on the move? Like, what is it about the world of work today that means when women hit natural transitionary points within their lives, they have to exit the workplace? So I think as a starting point for conversation, menstrual leave, menopause leave, different categories of leave that are age and stage related are key. But we do need to have a bigger conversation about how we help women to stay in the workplace, regardless of the age and the stage that they're at.
Now, both of you work in very female-friendly, female-focused companies. I wonder whether it's easier for people who work within firms like yours to take advantage of menstrual leave and menopause leave. There was a story recently about menopause leave that was introduced in Spain and the fact that a lot of people weren't actually taking it because there's still that kind of taboo that needs to be broken and people actually asking for it. Do you think it's enough to simply provide these things, or do you think it needs to go a stage further to actually encourage people to use it?
I think it's similar to what Sophie was just saying. It is a bigger issue. It's a bigger cultural issue. The reality, I think, keeping women in the workforce for a number of different reasons, whether that's your period, whether that's pregnancy, motherhood, whatever that looks like, there has to be cultural shifts around women at work. And I think that is the bigger issue. When we made our announcement around period leave, menopause leave, fertility leave, it all happened at the same time. And some of the comments that we got from men were, and women actually, to be fair, were very interesting and very backwards. And I think ultimately, culturally, when it comes to office work environment, we need to be changing how we work in general. We need to be having more open conversations. We need to be having flexible working. Only when we start having those things as part of a workforce every day will we start to see these other changes. So I think, yes, if you are in a workplace where you sit at your desk from 9 to 5:30, you don't leave until the boss leaves, you're not allowed to leave for any reason, doctor's appointments aren't allowed. If that's the culture you come from, and then suddenly someone gives you menopause leave, that's not going to be a comfortable conversation. People aren't going to feel comfortable taking that leave. If you work in an environment where flexible working is an option, where you're allowed to pick up your children from school, where you're allowed to go to the doctors for an appointment, when you're allowed to call in sick and people don't question you on that, and then they allow menopause leave, that's a completely different environment, and that's going to create a much happier, trusting, productive workforce.
And we're asking whether you would feel comfortable taking menopause leave, and particularly if it was mandated in law. This is on the back of a piece of news out of Australia. Now, senators there have been voting on the idea of bringing in a national policy on menopause and menstrual leave. And one senator there, Holly Hughes, yes, a woman, said that the practice could actually have the reverse impact of what they were hoping for, that it could discourage the hiring and promotion of women. And so I'm trying to kind of ask, you know, how far is too far on this stuff? Is that potentially a thing that we could see happening? Now, recently, Helen was joined here in the studio by James Lafferty. He is the CEO of Fine Hygienic Holdings, and he was explaining his company's policy with regards to menstrual leave and how he's communicated it to staff.
I'm very proud of our company. We felt the same way. And so we have a number of leaves. We have a menstrual leave, which is a day a month. So if you look at a normal menstrual cycle, there is typically a heavy flow day, a tough day, the highest level of cramping. We give every woman in the company a month, a one day a month, where they take that. It doesn't come from their vacation, and it's meant to be a stay-at-home day.
Can I ask how the men feel about that? Do they feel like they're being disadvantaged by not having a period?
Well, I think one time I said it on this show, I had only one man complain a number of years ago and said, this is unfair. And I said, then start menstruating. this is such BS. I mean, this is like a non-parent coming and complaining, you pay school fees for a parent, so why don't you give me some extra money? This is choices you've made.
Can I just say kudos to a man talking about heavy flow? Love to hear it. More of that, please. I am still joined in the studio by Polly Williams, who is managing partner at Tish Tash Communications, and Sophie Smith, the founder of digital women's health platform Nabta Health, both companies, I should say, which offer menopause and menstrual leave. Sophie, what do you think about that? Is it choices that we make that women should get this leave and men should just get on with it?
So it's an interesting question. I'm going to throw you a curveball. At NABTA, we offer shared parental leave. So men and women can take up to 9 months paid parental leave when they have a baby. 3 months full pay, 6 months half. And back when paternity leave was introduced, I'm sure people had the same questions. You know, if you introduce maternity leave, surely you will discourage companies from hiring women because companies will be worried about those women going on maternity leave. One of the ways to destigmatize and equalize that is to have shared parental leave. Then if both men and women, when they have a baby, can go on and take the same amount of leave, then there's no reason to hire a woman over a man or vice versa. There's an argument to be made for introducing andropause leave, mm-hmm. which is effectively the equivalent in men of menopause. It's a drop, often quite steep, in testosterone levels after the age of 40, that results in a lot of physical changes in men. Most importantly, in terms of their heart health, testosterone is responsible for maintaining muscle mass and bone density, but it also supports blood vessels, it supports the muscles around the heart. We know that in general, as women get into peri and postmenopause, where they fall sick, they tend to fall sick with different autoimmune diseases, so their bodies start to attack themselves. In men, the kind of opposite effect, they just drop down dead because of heart attacks.
Goodness.
So there's an argument to be made if you're going to introduce menopause leave into your company to also think about introducing andropause leave at the same time so that men can explore the chemical changes that are occurring in them and how those impact their overall physical, mental, and nutritional health. If you are a man in your 40s and 50s and you are starting to notice, and perhaps you wouldn't, but maybe your colleagues would, changes in mood, changes in weight, changes in how you think about or interact with your health, then to go and take care of those on an ongoing basis, to get checked, to interact with, you know, medical providers, it wouldn't necessarily be because you are sick. You're not. You're just going through a transitionary phase with your hormones. So there's a question to be asked. And it would be in the same way that having shared parental leave really destigmatized and kind of leveled the playing field around the stage of having a baby. If you introduced menopause and andropause leave, maybe they would look a little bit different, because equity isn't the same thing as equality, but at least it would immediately level the playing field and show that we understand that as men and as women, our bodies change as we age, and we need to make accommodations for that.
And that both parties deserve some accommodations for that. It's interesting, we've had a message in here from Brian Pinto. He's saying this seems to be a matter of taboo. If people could just be given an additional X amount of days of medical leave, then it would become up to women, or men indeed, who could decide to disclose what is the reason for the leave or not. And that would help the HR to determine the success of the project. I mean, I think the taboo thing is really interesting. I often wonder why there is such a taboo on this. I've kind of forced myself, I think, and now I'm quite comfortable with talking about the fact that I am in menopause, that I've been through that. But I wonder whether an element of that is because I was younger. I wonder how much of the attitude that people have about not sort of speaking up on menopause is because they fear that there's an ageism element to it. Is that something that you've seen as a concern from women talking about this, that they feel that it's sort of, it's talking about getting older, and that in itself is an uncomfortable subject?
I think historically, yes. I think things are changing. I think the conversation around menopause is rife at the moment, you know, everywhere. And I think that's an incredibly positive thing. I think ageism comes with its own challenges as well. But I think coming to the point that the caller made, I think essentially if we don't open those conversations, if we make it just about leave being leave, we're also not supporting our staff properly. If we know that someone is struggling with a period or menopause or whatever that may be, it's also our responsibility as employers to support them, find the right doctors. You know, we work with a number of different specialists. We work with Sophie a lot. We have Dr. Fiona. There's lots of really great people out there. And for a lot of people that might be experiencing, you know, symptoms for the first time and they don't have anywhere else to turn, having an employer that really understands them and knows how to support them will also create trust within your workforce and will create a much stronger bond with your team as well. So I think that, yes, you could absolutely just give leave. But ultimately, again, with everything, it's about opening those conversations and showing that you support your team and your staff. And by supporting your staff, they trust you, you trust them, and you're creating a better workforce. So I think that although it might sound like a more simpler solution, I think it's ultimately still not getting to the root issue that we're trying to discuss today.
We had a message from Brian. He was saying it seems to be a matter of taboo. Perhaps we could just be given medical leave and then it's up to us whether we choose to disclose the reason for that leave. Now, it sounds like a good idea, but Sophie, you were saying you have concerns about this idea, about the idea that we just call it medical leave.
Yes, for two reasons, actually. I think firstly, the over-medicalization of peri and post-menopause is not necessarily healthy. It's not a medical condition, although it's categorized as a pre-existing condition here.
Yes.
It's a stage in a woman's life, and a stage that it's possible to navigate very healthily. So to categorize it broad spectrum as medical leave is probably not helpful. I also think that from what we've seen both within NABTA and within the ecosystem, where you look at the statistics more broadly, you know, women are responsible for 80% of consumption decision making. We are responsible for 80% of caregiving globally. If you give women a broad bucket of leave, they will take it for absolutely everything except their own health. They will take it to go and watch their child in their end of term play. They will take it because their child is sick in hospital. They'll take it because they need to take an elderly parent to an appointment at the hospital. Unless you specify for women that this category of leave is to be used for this aspect of your health, probably she will never take it for that specific thing. So having clearly defined leave, showing women that it's okay to take leave for themselves, not just to honour their commitment to their families and to society more broadly, is, I think, really important.
Now, you made a really interesting point there, which is that it's kind of classed as a pre-existing condition here for a lot of people. And that has an impact too, doesn't it? What does that actually mean when it comes to trying to access care and particularly claim on insurance?
So if you have been diagnosed as peri or postmenopausal and you then apply for an individual insurance premium, it will be classified as a pre-existing condition, which means that probably the lowest you will be quoted is about 35,000 dirham per annum. But I've known women to be quoted as much as 180, even over 180,000, even over 200,000 dirham per annum, because they are peri or postmenopausal with a history of something like a cancer in their 20s or 30s. So if you take perimenopause and you couple it with another pre-existing condition, then the price of premiums racks up pretty quickly, which obviously then makes care and essential care, and not necessarily wildly expensive, but continuous care, for example, like access to hormone replacement therapy, very difficult for most women.
Gosh, that's really interesting. I had no idea that it could be as expensive as that. And I mean, I'm really lucky that I get HRT and menopause care covered on my husband's policy. But I'm gathering, the longer I'm here, that is very, very unusual. And I mean, as you say, HRT is not necessarily always expensive, but if you've had a health condition that has put you into menopause, that could be a hugely costly thing. And I mean, the point of us having this conversation, the reason that we're discussing menopause leave, is because a lot of companies are talking about introducing it. And we were saying off air that, you know, the big challenge here is that it feels a bit like the reason for this is to try and stop women leaving the workforce. And actually, where do we get that kind of solid run at those top jobs? Like, where is the time in a woman's life where she can really ramp up her focus on her career? If she's had kids and she goes back to work, you've got that kind of period where you're trying to get back into the swing of it after having kids. And then this can come and hit you as early as your late 30s or 40s. I mean, is this something that you're talking about with your female team a lot more now, Polly? Do you think there's more awareness of how we can navigate this territory and still hold on to our ambitions and our careers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an essential. We, you know, I think every month one of my team gets pregnant in that period, which is wonderful. But I think there is a fear, you know, in all women when they get pregnant that that's going to somehow stop their career. And so, yes, it's, you know, at the very basic level, that is something that we have to be talking to our teams about. And I think it's, you know, a sixth of all women will leave the workforce for some female related health issue. So whether that's pregnancy, menopause, period, whatever that might be, that's a huge number of women that we're losing globally that are perfectly capable of doing their jobs but are made to feel that they are not worthy of doing their jobs, or that they are not worthy over a man of potentially doing their job. So it is my responsibility as an employer to show women that that is not the case. And I know that we are very lucky to be able to have this outlook for our team. You know, Tash, who is the other founder of Tish Tash, and I are, you know, a fully female-focused company. We, you know, we are all women. We are able to make our own rules. And so for that reason, we're very, very lucky. And I think our team know that we are, you know, able to have a very different outlook. And I know it's not that easy for other employees to do that. But I think ultimately, again, it's about opening up those conversations and normalizing these things, because ultimately we will not be able to reach those top jobs, those leadership roles, if we keep losing women, you know, along the journey. And so we have to be having those conversations.
It feels like we've made huge strides on how we view pregnancy, but perhaps we're a bit further behind in the menopause conversation. Do you think it is being talked about more here and more openly, or do you think there's still quite a bit of taboo busting to be done on it, Sophie?
So I think if it wasn't talked about extensively here before this year, then it's going to be. I think there is still a huge amount of stigma attached to it. I mean, menopause in Arabic translates to the age of despair. We are trying to start a campaign to get it rebranded as the Age of Hope. But, you know, when the word for the age and the stage means the age of despair, you can dress it in whatever you like. It's still not going to be a particularly happy picture. So, yes, there's work to be done from a destigmatizing perspective. But I think, you know, you mentioned the upcoming GCC Menopause Summit on World Menopause Day, which is the 18th of October, the first of its kind in the region. And I know that we, with Tish Tash and with the other founding partners, are hoping that this will really open the floodgates. We would like... And everything that we do, by the way, as NABTA, is to establish the GCC as the new global hub of innovation for women's health. And menopause should be a significant part of that. We shouldn't be reliant on importing HRT. We should be finding new and better options for bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and we should be manufacturing them and shipping them from here. I think there are so many interesting areas, again, from an innovation perspective that we could be looking at within women's health, and menopause is not excluded from those.
So we've got two messages coming in, actually, from Julie here. She says, I love the hypothesis of the grandmother theory that challenges the theory that women who are no longer of childbearing age have value. I also think as a society we need to change. We celebrate a girl getting her first period and becoming a mother, but then the menopause is met with anxiety and negativity. And yet this is when we as women care less what people think, and our cognition often becomes its sharpest. A very fair point, Julie. And of course, that's a big part of what my guests in the studio are doing. Polly Williams is managing partner at Tish Tash Communications, and Sophie Smith is the founder of digital women's health platform NABTA. And both of them are involved in the upcoming first ever GCC Menopause Summit. Polly, tell me a bit about this, how it's come about, and what it's going to be covering for people.
Yes, so it is the brainchild of someone called Sharon James, who is a menopause and wellness and life coach here in Dubai. And essentially, it's all about breaking the taboo, which again is why we're here today. But I think, you know, we're doing it on World Menopause Day. We're all about bringing that kind of understanding. So many people are talking about it, but it's time to kind of put it on a bigger platform, really kind of bring that awareness to people. I think the reality is it, you know, it affects so many women as early as, you know, for your example, women in their 30s all the way up to kind of 50s. So we know it's a conversation that has to happen. It's obviously something that can feel very lonely with symptoms that range from, you know, headaches to things much more serious. So it's about time that we put all that information on the table for people in a way that is also informative, but fun, engaging, filled with loads of specialists that can really support with any questions that people might have. Obviously, Sophie is a big part of that. So from a kind of more medical point of view, she's probably better placed than me. But I think for us as Tish Tash, we really wanted to be involved because we want to break that taboo. We want to be part of really bringing this conversation to the forefront.
And I mean, on that conversation, I've been amazed by how many people that I talk to about menopause who are friends, who are in sort of my age range, who are, you know, late 30s, early 40s, who actually don't know an awful lot about the symptoms of perimenopause and what they should be looking out for, which of course is going to be a big part of the discussion at the summit. Sophie, what do you think about the level of awareness here, about the symptoms? Do you think people fully understand what is coming, what menopause looks like?
No is the very short answer to that question. But I think the biggest problem is that there are many, many symptoms of menopause, many of which, if they occurred in men, would be the sign of a very serious underlying health condition, like something like cancer or thyroid disease. But they are, as with many symptoms in women, often dismissed as normal. I think some of the most common symptoms that are not picked up but can manifest very early are things like elevated anxiety. It's one of the most common early symptoms, but one of the symptoms that is probably talked about or highlighted the least, or even picked up on by women themselves much later, sometimes when they're even approaching menopause or postmenopausal. Living in a hot country like Dubai, I think it's very easy to miss a lot of the other symptoms, like hot flashes. You could put it down to bad air conditioning or having been out outdoors. You know, any time that you are low in estrogen as a woman, you're likely to suffer with some of these symptoms, if you're breastfeeding, for example. And so, again, there are certain physical symptoms that you might not pick up because we're used to switching between the very cool and the very hot here. And so even those physical symptoms, perhaps you wouldn't pick up so early. I think there's a significant gap when it comes to education around how menopause is going to affect you from a physical, a mental, and a nutritional perspective. If you speak to one of our nutrition advisors, for example, she said, would tell you that with all of the women who come in and see her who are in their sort of early to mid-30s, she'll talk to them about perimenopause and will advise them to lose a couple of kilograms, even if they're a healthy weight. She said just that focusing on your physical health, on your levels of fitness, on your muscle mass, on your bone density, on what you're doing in terms of exercising and strength training and resistance training and using weights, having that thought process start before you enter perimenopause can transform the way that you navigate it. And thinking about what you eat and how you eat it and when you eat it and how you pair different food groups and, you know, what the kind of nutrient density is of those food groups, all of these things, if you could just get women a year or two before they entered perimenopause, that transitionary period could look very different.
It's so true. I see Dr. Fiona, and I, when I first saw her and she started talking to me about building muscle to deal with menopause, I thought, oh really, I've got to go to the gym now after surgery and I'm feeling this rubbish. And actually, it's completely changed the way that I have dealt with it. And I've started going to the gym quite religiously, and it made me feel a world better. But as you say, I don't think anyone had ever said to me prior to my surgery, prior to me going overnight into menopause, actually, you would be in much better nick for this if you would start building muscle, if you would look at your anxiety levels, sleep patterns, all of these sorts of things. I mean, the impact on sleep, I don't think, is discussed anywhere near enough. The insomnia that can come with it. There's so many symptoms. So how do people find out a bit more about how to get involved with the summit then, where you're going to be going into a lot more detail on all of this?
So we are still very in the early stages, just to be completely honest. So we are working on the website as we speak. It will be live early next week. And you can just, if you just Google Menopause Summit GCC, the information will appear. It's going to be happening. Where is it happening, Sophie?
It's happening at the Museum of the Future. Ooh. And this was important for us because we want to make it very, very clear that discussions around menopause belong in the future of the workplace and of healthcare in general. There is a page live now at gccmenopausesummit.com. You can go and you can subscribe for more information. In the first week and a half, with no PR around it, we had 450 people sign up. We only have, I think, 325-ish tickets for this first menopause summit. We were conservative and then thought maybe we shouldn't have been. But I think it's going to be the idea, the objective of the summit is to inform and educate and break down barriers and open doors. We have a lot of really interesting discussions and panelists. We're showcasing a lot of the innovation that is being done here in the UAE and wider GCC. A lot of the experts that are coming in are also experts in their various fields, again, here in the region, so that for women who attend the summit, it's not that they hear somebody speak who they can't then see. They're hearing and listening to and building trust with healthcare providers who they can go and then book appointments with directly. So we do, you know, we want the attendees of the conference to come away feeling empowered and feeling like they understand menopause a lot better and they know where they need to get the support that they want.
Polly, Sophie, thank you so much for your time. That is bringing today's show to a close. If you enjoyed this podcast or the show, please do share and tag us on social media. We are Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Afternoons with Helen Farmer is live Monday to Friday, 2 until 5.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.